This morning's opening words come from the poet who won the Nobel Prize from Poland, Wisława Szymborska. Under one small star. My apologies for calling it necessity. My apologies to necessity if I'm mistaken after all. Please don't be angry. Happiness with the way that my memory fades, and as I take my due, please don't be angry, my dead, be patient with the way my memories fade. My apologies to time, for all the world I overlooked the second. Forgive me distant wars for bringing flowers home. Pardon me hounded hope for laughing time to time. Pardon me, deserts, that I don't rush up to you bearing a spoonful of water. My apologies to the felled trees for the table's four legs. My apologies for small answers. Dignity, please be magnanimous. Bear with me, O mystery of existence, as I pluck the occasional thread from your train. Welcome, everybody, on this fine spring morning, misty, smoky, and the daffodils blooming on the hillside of our good friend Doug's place as you drive down the lane. We welcome all of you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Whether you perceive the cosmos with the poet's eye or the scientist's scrutiny, we welcome you here. We welcome you no matter what focuses your life or who you love, you are welcome here. Please take a moment to greet those around you. Okay, everyone. It's now time for me to share the words that will precede the lighting of our flaming chalice. These words come from the Tao Te Ching. Seeing into darkness is clarity. Knowing how to yield is strength. Use your own light and return to the source of light. This is called practicing eternity. Now let us stand as you are able and sing our opening hymn. Number 44, we sing of golden mornings.
We sing of flashing stars.
Please pay attention to the announcements in our order of service. They help give structure and meaning to our shared lives outside of our Sunday mornings together. And in addition to that, I'd like to share with you that the Story for All Ages and Anthem will be moved up a bit. So be prepared for that shift. And you should all be receiving an invitation to a wedding on May 3rd when Charles and I will be celebrating our Kansas wedding here. And we hope that everyone in this fellowship feels welcome and invited and will come and celebrate with us. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would like to do so now, please share a brief personal statement of joy or sorrow or that wonderful mix.
I'm Harriet Yonke, and in light of last night's MAPJ meeting on immigration, this announcement's particularly important. My son-in-law, Rod, Rhonda's husband, is from Iraq, and he has been waiting for his citizenship to happen for 20 years. He has spent thousands and thousands of dollars on lawyer's fees, starting in Fort Collins, where he graduated from Colorado State with a PhD in geology. And he had they have jumped through so many hoops. And at one point, they thought they were going to have to move to Canada and then come back. And that's what the speaker had mentioned about having to move back home or back to their home country for 10 years. Well, that's what one lawyer had told them. They would have moved to Canada for 5 years or something. But anyway, got a different lawyer, different papers, and finally got it done. We had to immigrate the naturalization ceremony a week ago Friday in Kansas City. There were... there were 185 others that were celebrating and had friends and family there. And they read off the name of each person and their home country and their occupation. And it was amazing, the number of doctors and lawyers and nurses and teachers and professors and all walks of life, but all of them contributing greatly to our society.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a combined joy and concern. The concern is that Slavomir sent me an email yesterday morning saying that Deepak was sick, his car was in bad shape, and needed a lot of help, and he wasn't sure whether he could be here by 9 o'clock this morning for the rehearsal. So I called Renee, and Renee said, oh, sure, no problem, I'll be there. But she said, and she's done well, we're grateful to you, Renee, for stepping in on short notice. And she's not going to play the Tchaikovsky for the offertory, but she is playing perhaps an even nicer piece, Rondino by Antonio Diabelli. But it won't sound like Shakespeare, or like Tchaikovsky.
Hello. I have a friend of mine. This is a concern. He has a dog that he has to get rid of. It's a pit bull. And I want to know if anybody is interested in the pit bull. He's papered and he's tacked for in case you want to breed him or something, but he's really sweet. His name is Crunch. And if anybody, yeah, because he crunches down, he's got strong jaws. But he's a very sweet dog, and if anybody would like to take him, because he lives in Ogden, and Ogden said, ah, we found out you got a pit bull, so he can't have him. So if anybody would like to take Crunch or knows anybody, we don't want him to go to a shelter because we're afraid somebody will pick him up and use him as a fighting dog or something. So we would hope to find a good home for him. So thank you. And if you want, if know anybody or want crunch or want, know anybody who wants crunch, just let me know. Thank you.
William Wolfe, sorry.
I had a, Gene Severs. I had a pleasant surprise a few minutes ago that my brother Randy is visiting this morning.
All right.
Shirley Hobrock with membership. We have a new member that just signed this morning, Chris Bailey. Chris, you want to stand up?
All right. Some people...
Molly McGoy, thank you to anybody who came for the Pride Parade yesterday or just waved as we saw you in Aggieville. I think there were almost 20 adult UUs and probably 10 kids, and it was a really nice celebration and a beautiful day. And the first of my daffodils I planted last fall has bloomed. So everything is well with the world.
And I'm Kathy Hedge. I want to thank you all for your great support for when my mom fell ill, and she is improving, and I sure appreciate that. And I have some very happy news to share, and that is the day before yesterday, we got a sweet little email with a picture of my mom and her sweetheart, just their hands, and they both exchanged rings. So my mom sure has something to live for.
All right. May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts. All right, the story for all ages. Oh, the anthem, sorry, got it backwards. We need Michael to keep this in order here.
Thank you. Hi, guys.
Is this, can we hear me? Okay. So today we are going to, Jocelyn and I both are going to read A Lost Button by Arnold Lobel. It's one of the Frog and Toad. I'm sure everyone knows Frog and Toad. Yeah? Do you want to start? Okay.
Frog and Toad went for a long walk. They walked across a large meadow. They walked in the woods. They walked along the river. At last, they went back home to Toad's house. "Oh, drat," said Toad.
"Not only do my feet hurt, but I have lost one of the buttons off my jacket."
"Don't worry," said Frog. "We'll go back to all the places where we walked. We will soon find your button." They walked back to the large meadow. They began to look for a button in the tall grass.
"Here is your button," cried Frog. "That is not my button," said Toad. "That button is black. My button was white." Toad put the black button in his pocket.
A sparrow flew down. "Excuse me," said the sparrow. "Did you lose a button? I found one." "That is not my button," said Toad. "That button has two holes. My button has four holes." Toad put the button with two holes in his pocket.
They went back to the woods and looked on the dark paths. "Here is your button," said Frog. "That is not my button," cried Toad. "That button is small. My button was big." Toad put the small button in his pocket.
A raccoon came out from behind a tree. "I heard you were looking for a button," he said. "Here is one that I just found. That is not my button." "Well, Toad, that button is square. My button was round." Toad put the square button in his pocket.
Frog and Toad went back to the river. They looked for the button in the mud. "Here is your button," said Frog. "That is not my button," shouted Toad. "That button is thin. My button was thick."
Toad put the thin button in his pocket. He was very angry. He jumped up and down and screamed, "The whole world is covered with buttons, and not one of them is mine."
Toad ran home and slammed the door. There, on the floor, he saw his white, four-holed, big, round, thick button. "Oh," said Toad. "It was here all the time. What a lot of trouble I have made for Frog."
Toad took all the buttons, all of the buttons out of his pocket. He took the sewing box down from the shelf. Toad sewed the buttons all over his jacket.
The next day, Toad gave his jacket to Frog. Frog thought it was beautiful. He put it on and jumped for joy. None of the buttons fell off. Toad had sewed them on very well. The end.
With you. Shine your light in all you do. Hope and open hearts go with you. Oh, in joy our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. So now is our one of our favorite times of the month. It's not the second Sunday, but is Donna here? All right, Donna, come on up. And we are going to hear why fairy godmothers need our help.
Well, thank you for allowing me to come and tell the fairy godmother story and for your generosity to serve our cause. The Fairy Godmothers organization for the greater Manhattan area began with the desire of two local women, Polly Steckline and Lori Cross. Their dream was to establish a fund with women helping women. In April of 2006, a steering committee was formed and the dream became a reality. In August of 2006, this new steering committee and the Greater Manhattan Community Foundation held a party at the train depot to kick off this new Women's Helping Women's Fund. The number of fairy godmothers in this area has grown since 2006 to over 640 fairies. With their support and with the help of the folks like you, our ability to grant funds to local women has grown tremendously. In 2013, we awarded 82 grants with an average grant of $395. I want to share with you just a few grants that were given. Keep in mind the rippling effect. In addition to the recipient herself, many family members, including children and the elderly, benefit from these grants. Grants requests have paid for furnace repairs, a well pump, eye exams and glasses. Many grants have gone for car repairs so women can get to their jobs. Diabetic shoes and inserts were one grant, a used washer and dryer for a family, a water heater, tuition to Manhattan Area Technical College, a grant for a temporary home care attendant, dentures and other dental work, and automobile insurance are just a few examples of where grant contributions are used. The need is great. Each year we take our yearly budget for grants and divide it into the quarters. The money allocated for January, February, and March of this year was paid out in grants before the month of January was over. Your generosity supporting the fairy godmothers and their mission of women helping women is greatly appreciated. I also brought a few brochures that tell more about the Fairy Godmothers program. I'll put those in the back if that's okay. And for you men, I just thought I'd put in a little word. As of about 3 months ago, the Greater Manhattan Community Foundation and a group of men are organizing the Guardian Angels, which will be men helping men within our community along the same lines as Fairy Godmothers. Thank you.
Now is a special time in the cycle of our life here at the fellowship. We're welcoming our new members this morning. So would all those members who are in the program or should Tim come up? Chris? What? No? Oh, he had to leave. So anyway, after the choir, that happens. So everyone, please come forward who is a new member that will be recognized today. That's right, he mentioned that to me, I forgot. If you just kind of come on over here. All right, great. Oh, good. Today, we welcome into our community Meliz Mata, Jessica Sievers, Dixie Moreau, Amanda Mansfield, Catherine Kreitz, who's not here, Karen Garrett, who's not here, Mary Lynn Higginbotham, and sorry, I had to do that. I love that name. And Jonathan Mahorney and Amber Reed have chosen to become members. They have chosen to make a commitment to this congregation by signing our membership book. New members, we are so glad to have you here with us and that you have chosen this community of fellow seekers to travel with you on your life journeys. Will you accept our gifts of fellowship, discovery, and service? Will you offer as your unique presence, your unique presence and gifts? Will you add your name to the long history of Unitarian Universalist men and women who spread hope with their living faith? Will you engage with us as we seek to create a community and a world dedicated to love and justice? If you do say, we will.
We will.
All right. Thank you so much. Congregation, will you welcome these new members with the warmth and support of our fellowship? Will you seek to add your strengths and talents to the new gifts they bring us? Will you share our triumphs and our struggles as our community grows and changes? If so,
we will.
All right. Let us seek together with common purpose and common love the acceptance of our beautiful diversity of belief. Let us commit ourselves anew to dwell together in peace, to seek truth and love, to help one another and all those who may need this vision of progressive faith. Thank you, Shirley, for doing such tremendous work.
And we had a breakfast this morning for new people and new members, and I'd like to thank everyone that brought food, Sylvia and Linda Krieger and our regular, all our social committee. We thank you.
Michael asked me to comment about something I mentioned in a conversation not long ago called the illusion of reality. And I have 4 or 5 minutes to convince you that everything you see and do and experience is just an illusion. Last week I gave the same presentation to a group at ECM, and I had 60 minutes to do it. But I hope to leave you with a few things to think about before we are done. Most all legitimate scientists agree on one thing, that there are two great mysteries in the cosmos, things that confound us and that we know so little about, and they are very important and they affect us. The first of these is gravity, and the second one is human consciousness. Now, we all think we know what gravity is. Remember when Isaac Newton looked up and an apple hit him on the head? And he said, aha, that's something we need to think about. And Isaac Newton developed all of the laws of gravity. And in fact, we still use those mathematical laws today. Every moonshot, every trajectory of anything that leaves the Earth is managed by Isaac Newton's laws of gravity. They are still valid on that scale. But we really don't know what gravity is. Some people say, well, it must be gravitons. Well, it's particles. We know that gravity is, well, two bodies are attracted to one another, and we get the general idea that, the sun has gravity, and that's what keeps the Earth moving around. And in fact, gravity is one of the four main forces, in fact, the only four sources in the universe. And I won't go into detail of what its characteristics are, but we really don't know what it is. Well, just a couple of weeks ago, a research team at the South Pole, understanding that the atmosphere is thinnest there, took some more other looks at something called the afterglow. This is the radiation left over from the Big Bang. The light from the afterglow is still arriving 13.72 billion years ago, and we can map it. Well, the latest maps of the afterglow show structure. They show polarization, and aha, we finally see gravity waves. Gravity is a wave function. Think of the ocean. Waves, well, just think of force being in waves. This is being touted as one of the greatest discoveries of the last 100 years. Well, there's a reason why I mentioned gravity, because, believe it or not, it's being related in many studies as related to human consciousness. Just think about human consciousness, what a marvelous thing it is. Many living things have conscious facilities, like a flatworm has a few cells that respond to temperature and light and so forth. But the highest form of evolution in the cosmos that we know about today is human consciousness. Well, I've spent quite a bit of thought trying to prove that the brain is just another digital computer. It's just like the computers we have on our desktops and we carry around in our pockets. But that isn't true. They're not really like at all, even though our brain is what I call a carbon computer, and the mechanical electronic kind is a silicon computer. Well, there's a relationship that I won't go into, but actually we have this marvelous piece of protoplasm carried around in our heads with an electrical potential of about 20 volts, about 20 watts of power, and operates at 60 cycles. Well, that sounds like pretty much an electrochemical, biochemical machine, doesn't it? Well, if somebody calls you a meathead, well, say thank you. The protoplasm, the cells that we carry around in our heads are acting in a way that are very, very special. Well, The brain is not a computer because of many different things. It doesn't have an operating system. It doesn't have programs, and it does not use a single processor. It is simply a network of cells that are communicating electrically with each other. And that is what we call human consciousness. This electrical activity that goes on in the head. Well, why does it make sense? And why do we make sense? It is often said that humans are the only living being to know that there is a tomorrow and can think ahead. Think about that a minute. Does your dog know that there's a tomorrow? Does your cat or any other living thing? Well, no, only humans. And the way this happens is that the human body and many other animals have sensors. Your eyes, your ears, all of the senses that go on and detect light, detect radiation, detect other things that are in our cosmos. These images are brought to this processing center, a parallel processor that we have in our brains, and we develop images of things, images of reality. But is that really real? Are those images really real? And the answer is, well, no. Because think about when you're asleep, you're dreaming, what happens? Do you stop perceiving and thinking and doing? Well, no, you have dreams. You develop images. Well, your brain cells continue to fire in your brain. There's electrical activity, and you're creating images as such. So that is considered as part of the argument for why your consciousness really and what goes on in your head is only an illusion. Well, there are many other ways to prove that. Some societies think of mind out of body and other things, but that's another story. Well, space and time, most of what drives the cosmos, are also fundamental dimensions of consciousness. And some people say, well, artificial intelligence is overtaking us. Some days computers are going to be smarter than we are, and we're going to be governed by robots. Well, that's not going to happen because no matter how well you can program a computer, it is not going to overtake the ability of the human consciousness to make decisions and to operate. Well, that's all the time I have, but simply to say the future of space, time, and mind and their ultimate meaning for the cosmos are yet to be discovered. If only we would spend big money on the mind in the same way that we spend money on big science, like the Large Hadron Super Collider, why we might be further ahead.
The title Inside the Little Universe comes directly from Bryce, not directly, but indirectly. I was listening to Science Friday on NPR a couple weeks ago when the researchers from MIT, Harvard, and the University of Arizona who revealed this new information that Bryce was talking about the gravitational waves and the first light. And they said this phrase, inside the little universe. I said, Chuck, write that down. I don't want to forget that. And it was such an amazing conversation these three scientists and Ira Flatow and the callers had about this incredible discovery. But as a poet, I was listening to the language, and the language was just so rich. And at one point they said, this is where metaphysics turns into science. And I was thinking, no, this is where science and metaphysics equal each other, because there's such poetic richness in these images. And I'd like to share a few of them with you. Hot dense infancy, oldest direct picture, a grand unified scale, little swirls, the bang and the big bang, uniformity of universe, a period of exponential expansion, the universe smaller than anybody ever thought, the tiny speck becoming, grew almost 10 to the 90th power in a millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second from the size of an atom to the size of a grapefruit. It takes essentially nothing to create a universe. The beginning of the universe, gravitational waves, allow us to look back at the beginning of time. Microwave radiational gravitational waves in the early universe, quantum effects of gravity, the first trillionth of a second in search of ancient light, 14 or 15 orders of magnitude, a mind game that turns out to be true. It's a lot easier to look for something when you know what to look for. So this multi-universe that they're talking about is really something that I think impacts us as Unitarian Universalists in ways that I can't even begin to explicate. Bryce tried, and he did a great job. I'm not going to go that route, but I do think it's a wonderful contrast to a more metaphysical understanding of how all this works. And the main thing that I get out of this for me as a human being and as a minister is that out of the very smallest, almost undetectable bit of matter, the whole universe expanded. So out of very small things, big things can happen. What a great lesson. So if you are ever feeling like nothing is working out, look for something small in your life that is working out. Pay attention to it. Look at it. Because one of the things they found with this telescope that they put over the South Pole so they could track this gravitational waves for 3 years was that no one else had done that before. And once they had figured out this was a way to look at ancient light, the beginning of light in the universe, it opens the doors for other scientists to know where to look. So if you know that in small things, big things can come, it's really important as a Unitarian Universalist to challenge yourself to figure out what that might mean for you and your family and your friends and your loved ones. I mean, we're called to be creative, to mix things up, but eventually we're called to figure out where it begins in us, this impulse to grow into whole and authentic and real human beings. As Unitarian Universalists, we are encouraged to have our own philosophy of life. And we also understand that something that guides and shapes this search is that truth is not absolute. It reveals itself over time. So we should be in a continuous search for truth. A truth that reveals itself inside of us, inside of our lives, inside of each breath, and not some abstract idea. That it is a living thing as well. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and justice. Ideas should be open for discussion. We care about social justice, personal peace, and harmony. But it has to begin inside. It has to begin inside in a place where you recognize your own humanity. And it's that connection, that little connection inside you, that helps me to connect to Amy, to Michael, to Jean. But if you don't have that connection here, inside of you, it's hard to relate. It's just an abstraction. It's not real. It may be an illusion, but it's a good illusion. And one of the people I turn to when I think of Unitarian Universalist heroines who inspire me to really take a deep and hard look at the personal responsibility of really not allowing your deficits, the things that you can't do, all those things that tell you no in life, to turn that around, is Clara Barton. She was born on Christmas Day in 1821. Her mother was insane. Her sister taught her how to read. She had a lisp. She was a slight girl. She was teased all the time, and she had a great fear of being in public. So her family decided to send her to a school for a term, and she just shrunk into nothing. But when she was 11 years old, her elder brother, who had taught her how to ride a horse, had an accident while working on building a house. It was such a severe accident that he was laid up for a year, and Clara Barton devoted the 2 years of her adolescence to helping her brother recover. She was the main source of support and sustenance and care for this brother she loved dearly. Her days of childhood play ended abruptly when her brother fell from the construction site. And what she figured out is that for her, she needed to be needed. Throughout her life, with her many great accomplishments, she suffered from depression. And the only thing that would bring her out of that place of darkness into a place where she felt connected was when she was helping. So for her, she needed to be needed. And when she was about 18 or 19, she became a school teacher, and it just terrified her. She didn't know how she was going to teach kids that she knew that were almost her age. But because her brother taught her how to ride a horse and play games with her, she was as strong and as able as they were. And the school was amazed that this was the only school in the district that had no problems with discipline. How did that happen? She goes, because there's no problem, she said. I get along with them. Kind of revolutionary, isn't it? So she became famous for being able to run a classroom without discipline problems, so the state of New Jersey hired her to start the first public school for children where they didn't have to pay to go to school. She started the school, and it began running so beautifully, but then they hired a headmaster for $600 a year, and she was only being paid $275. She started it, she ran it, and when she got it going, they said, we need to get a man in here, and we're going to not only pay him double, but we're going to pay him a little more than double. This did not set well with her. She said, forget it. I will not accept this discrimination. So she moved to Washington, D.C., where she got a job in the patent office. She was the first woman to work in the United States Patent Office. So another remarkable thing. Here she finds herself this little girl with a lisp who's teased. She moves up through the school and educational system and gains power and a sense of what she can do, and then she's pushed back, and then she moves away from that and goes to Washington. And during that time, the Civil War broke out. And that's where we all know the story of Clara Barton. She just gave everything of herself to gather supplies and to mend the wounded. She worked with Civil War people who were in prisons. She worked with the Union forces. She did everything she could to organize and to protect and to help and to lead people into good health again. So she gave her life to that. And at some point, You know, the war was over, and President Lincoln said she did a great job. She was honored, and she didn't know what to do. She fell into depression again. So she took a trip, as many people are wont to do when they're depressed, and she went to Germany and France, and while she was there, the Franco-Prussian War broke out. And having just heard the Geneva Convention, which established the International Red Cross, she offered her services to the organization. She set up centers in several war-torn cities. She was awarded the Iron Cross and urged to found an American Red Cross. She urged the government's signature of the Geneva Convention, thus far ignored in the United States, and the establishment of an American Red Cross. On May 12, 1881, this Universalist woman was proud to see the American Red Cross recognized. At the 1882 ratification of the Geneva Convention, she received the highest decoration by the International Red Cross. So just look at the arc of that story. The youngest child with a history in a family with a history of insanity, the mother and the sister were locked upstairs in her bedroom. She was teased by all of her peers because of this lisp, and she goes on to be one of the most powerful women of the 19th century in terms of moving health care forward in a way that is still operational today. So, a great Universalist story. And I think we can all be inspired here again to see how when someone starts out not knowing, it doesn't mean they're not going to figure it out. And it doesn't mean they can't do something big. So it's an invitation for each of us here to not let go of those little dreams that someday may foster something we can't imagine right now. You know, as artists, people who paint and draw and sculpt, they're always creating something from almost nothing. With chalk, with a pencil, with a paintbrush, with clay. There's something beautiful and amazing arises that stirs the deepest parts of our imagination. The same with music. Someone hears a melody in their head that they can't get out, and they've got to put it on paper. They've got to share it. And then we have beautiful music like we had this morning. The anthem was just beautiful. So how lucky are we for these things, these small things that grow and become bigger? They're like the seeds that we plant in the ground this time of year. Like that oak tree, it once was an acorn. So from a very small thing grows something magnificent. Cornel West, a PhD author and professor of African-American studies at Princeton, when asked, "What do you do to make your life better?" said, "Most people try to escape their daily lives through stimulation or titillation, but spiritual uplift happens through real connection, conversation, community, action, music. I lift up my spirits listening to Mahalia Jackson." And all parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles out there, it's so important to teach this lesson of how important it is to nurture those small dreams inside of you and to give them the experience of giving. Because it's through this giving nature that so much comes to fruition. So one of the suggestions I might have is every night talk to your child or children about what they're thankful for. Help them develop a sense of appreciation and gratitude for all the things that they're given and share that with them. Review the beautiful things that have happened in that day so that they can carry that into their dreams. and help them give stuff away. There's a story about one man and his son who were giving a Halloween candy to kids that came to the door, and the son just loved it. He was about 4 years old, but that wasn't enough to just to give to kids who came to the door. He was running down to the street to adults who were coming home from work, giving them candy. He said, "You need some candy." Now, what a great impulse. What would it be like if we were like that? "Oh, Bryce, I've got some eggs for you," or something like that. You know, I mean, just this impulse and to follow through with generosity and a sense of appreciation and gladness. As spring warms the earth, plant some seeds and watch the kale, lettuce, and chard grow. Harvest and share. So we have a few moments today. I really tried, even though it's just been an incredibly beautiful and filled morning, to have a little bit of sharing. So what do you do, or how have small things in your life turned out to be important in ways that you might not have ever guessed they would be? And how has that helped you to become a better person? I know there are a lot of good people out there.
So a quick story. Again, I'm Kathy Hedge. Went to Target. They have $1 sidewalk chalk that's really bright. And just the idea of going out with a grandson and writing "Happy Spring" on a smooth sidewalk and drawing flowers. I mean, part of it got erased overnight, but to look out there and still see "Sappy Pring" is what was left. But it was still, you know, it's still really pretty. And just that little bit of finding joy in a $1 package of sidewalk chalk is wonderful.
I shouldn't have worn heels.
Well, one thing that's getting me going towards spring is I help out at a greenhouse, and we got the plants coming up and all that, and we got tons of tomatoes, but you know, transplanting things, and it just makes me feel more alive, and I'm noticing more things like the leaves coming out of the trees and all that, starting to bud out, and the flowers are coming up, and I was turning the soil for the LEC garden, and we had worms in there, and I was like, I throw them back into the ground and all, and I'm like, you know, because they aerate the soil and all, and just small things make things come alive for me. That's all.
Yeah. Thank you, Sabrina. Back and forth.
I have a quick, small nature story. I was arriving late, and Amber was coming out the door. I didn't see Amber. I didn't know that. I was walking up the steps, and two robins were in some kind of combat chase thing. They went right in front of me, almost ran into me. And then there was this cluster of them off to the side, but there was just this incredible spring energy. And, you know, I don't know what exactly was happening there, but Amber saw it too. So that, you know, when I saw her, we looked at each other and we immediately started laughing. But it was one of those, you know, it's just serendipity. It's spring.
Anna Franklin. Before spring break, I don't know if you all remember, and we had all that snow and a lot of dreary days, and it was a long winter. At least for me, it was a long winter. And I was just kind of holding my breath until it would be over. And I remember going to teach one day, and I drove into the parking lot, and it was dreary, snowy. I got out of the car. It was kind of messy, and there was mud everywhere. The snow was melting. And then I looked, and right in front of the car was a big bank of snow with daffodils blooming, popping right up out of the snow. And it just changed everything. My whole mindset was changed. And, you know, moments like that happen, and they happen quite a lot if we pay attention. So,
Sabrina got me thinking about growing things, and I realized that 7 years ago, when I first bought my house, the first vegetable garden I planted, the one crop that took off were these jalapenos, and they were hot. I mean, they were, and I had thousands of these things. And I could only eat so many. And what's funny is that giving them away actually helped me to make friends with some people that I know I wouldn't have otherwise. The first friend I made was a grad student who I'd honestly felt was kind of difficult when I first met this person. I brought a big bowl of the jalapenos with little paper bags, and at the end of class, I had invited students to take some. This student then started mailing me recipes for jalapeno poppers, all kinds of recipes. And to this day, we're still good friends. I just had lunch with her last week, and I don't think we would have connected. And the other friend I made, I have a set of neighbors across my alley who are very, very conservative Christian, very, very politically conservative. And we've somehow managed to have a 7-year friendship without me being judgmental of them. And it started with these jalapenos also. So maybe that's the power of those little growing things in the spring.
That's great. One more story? All right. No? Okay. Thank you, everyone. So let us now sing our closing hymn, 312, Here on the Paths of Every Day. Let me share these closing words from the Tao Te Ching. Seeing into darkness as clarity, knowing how to yield as strength, use your own light and return to the source of light. This is called practicing eternity. Darkness within darkness, the gateway to all understanding.